Item number four, which is the Puget Sound clam and oyster season. This is a briefing and a public hearing, and reporting will be Rich Childers, our Puget Sound shellfish manager. Welcome to the other side of the state, Rich.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Director Unsworth, Deputy Director Store. For the record, my name's Rich Childers, and I'm the manager of a team that oversees shell fisheries in Puget Sound. And today I'm here to do a briefing on rule changes for 2015 seasons on public beaches for clam and oysters. Few things on the outline here. I'm going to just do a quick overview of our cooperative management of shell fisheries in Puget Sound and a look at a couple of our mandates for cooperative management by way of review pertaining to intertidal shellfish and treaty rights and why these changes are needed on an annual basis, a review of any public input or comment that we've had on these proposed rule changes, which we generally do not get any. These are pretty non-controversial changes. Then our proposed season change and an opportunity for questions. So we have a process for cooperative shellfish management in Puget Sound that started in 1995 after the federal court ruling that I will discuss a little bit further in the next slides. We have a series of co-managers, our department, WDF&W, DNR is part of the shellfish management, Department of Health, state parks, and we have 14 treaty tribes that have usual and accustomed fishing grounds within Puget Sound. We develop annual harvest agreements between all these stakeholder groups and agencies and tribes for that list of species that you see there, and intertidal clams and oysters are what we're going to talk about today. But we also do it for the subtitle geoduck clam, wild stock fishery, Dungeness crab, shrimp, urchins, cucumbers, squid, and crayfish. And I think that covers all of them. So a lot of harvest agreements are being created with the tribes every year. We have, I don't want to go read through all of these and put you to sleep, but the gist of this is we do have a federal court order that was handed to us in 1994 from Judge Rafiti, known as a Rafiti decision, that basically reaffirmed treaty rights to 50% of all harvestable shellfish in Puget Sound, and also that they have equal say in the co-management of these resources. And the second document that we were handed by the court is the implementation plan, and that's what we work off of, and it says here's how you will do business with the treaty tribes. A couple of key points pertaining to today's discussion. It does say in the implementation plan that we will share equally with the tribes on a bed-by-bed basis, which means beach-by-beach in Puget Sound. And the tribes are allowed to take up to 50% of the harvestable biomass from each beach. And these are public tide lands. The private tide lands is also in the mix, but we're not going to talk about that today. And the state has a responsibility for basically controlling our harvest and so forth so as to not to damage those treaty rights and their ability to harvest shellfish on these public tide lands. So what we do, we have a crew that I oversee that we do harvest surveys, we do harvest surveys and biomass surveys on an annual basis through a series of public tide lands, either state parks, county parks, DNR properties throughout Puget Sound. And these are surveys are focused on the high use, high effort beaches, like very popular state parks and so forth. And we also, of course, have to do our harvest estimates. How much is a recreational fishery taking from these? And all this is put into the management plans and through the negotiations every year to come up with seasons for the following year. So why are these changes needed? We do see changes in clam and oyster abundance on these beaches for a variety of reasons. It can be overharvest of a state or treaty share the previous year, changes in projected effort. We have models that will predict how much effort we're going to have on for recreational on these public tide lands, and it's based on the number of low tides that there is in a season, how many of those fall on a weekend, how many are on a holiday, and so forth. Then we have changes in water quality. We can have beaches that are open or closed due to water quality changes, and that's monitored by the Department of Health. So we do have the rule change proposals posted on our department website. They've been out there for months, along with the list of changes and the CR 102 and WAC changes. We distribute this to our contact list. We have about 1,700 that's maintained on the Fish and Wildlife contact list now through email. And we receive no comments or public input on these proposed changes, and that is not uncommon. Primarily because there's a lot of effort, a lot of opportunity for recreational harvest throughout Puget Sound. So some of these changes that we make on these beaches that are going to lengthen a season or shorten a season doesn't really impact folks too much, because there's always opportunity right down the road and usually pretty close. So, and that's the case at this point. So I've been doing this for a number of years, and to date we've only had one public comment in the years that I've been presenting this to the commission, and that was more about a nighttime harvest opportunity. So I'm not going to go through all these. They're in your packets, but we have 19 public tide lands that we're going to make changes on for clam and oyster season. This is the list of the clam season changes based on just abundance and harvest effort and so forth. And you see, it's a mix. Some areas there's an increase, some there's a decrease, and some we see a shift in the season. We may have the same number of days, but we'll shift the season earlier in the summer or later in the summer to control the effort. The same with the oyster season changes, a mix of increases, decreases, and some shifting in the dates. And then we have four beaches that were actually open this year, first time 2015, due to water quality changes, which is a good little plus mark for us. It's one of our mandates in the Washington Shellfish Initiative that we're working with health to get some of these beaches upgraded, work with upland landowners to improve septic systems and so forth. So these are beaches that have been closed for a number of years because of water quality. Well, they're now opening up for recreational and treaty harvest in 2015. And that's kind of it in a nutshell, and I will entertain any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Mr. Kuehl. Thank you. I just had a quick question about overall trends in abundance for Puget Sound clams and oysters. Are we seeing any trends? And then same question concerning recreational harvest.
Recreational harvest, we are not seeing any upward or downward trends. It seems to be pretty stable. It does move around a bit. And we do, you may think, how do we estimate effort? We fly over these beaches almost daily throughout the summer during low tide. We have different strata. We fly at high tide, low tides, extreme low tides, and we're counting the effort. And then we're creeling to get catch rates throughout Puget Sound. The effort hasn't been changing much. It's pretty stable. Populations overall, I would say, are stable. Some of these beaches we do enhance, so that's kind of a wild card in that. We actually have a pretty robust enhancement program in our department where we plant clam and oyster seeds on some of these very high-use beaches. But some that are natural stocks are, in fact, last year, we saw some of the highest recruitment of oysters that we've seen in 15 years on some of these beaches, which is quite puzzling because it's kind of contrary to some of the news that you're hearing about ocean acidification and so forth. So we're working very closely with the Center on Ocean Acidification at the University of Washington, looking at our natural recruitment data versus what they're seeing in aquaculture facilities and so forth. So overall, populations are pretty stable and healthy.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Sure. Chair Smith, thank you. Being an East Sider, I think I've gone clam digging about half a dozen times in my life, so this is a very interesting subject to me. One thing, and it isn't related to your, but how prevalent is organized crime, poaching? I just had read an article the other day about a very major poaching ring. And
yes.
Needless to say, if you knew about it, you'd bust them. But I
yeah, we that's the poaching take illegal harvest on, well, it's intertidal bivalve, it's all shell fisheries. We're seeing it's a big problem, and it's we put a lot of enforcement effort into it. In fact, next month you're going to get a report on crab and shrimp, and Deputy Chief Sensi will be co-presenting that with me and give you some data on crab poaching and compliance. But it's a very big problem. So we have several categories of the problem. We have the geoduck clam, which you see in the picture here, very, very high dollar item, and we're seeing increase in poaching effort there, particularly in areas of Puget Sound where there's no upland houses. The ability to go in and poach at night with commercial gear when these clams are worth $30, $40 a piece, and you can get three or four a minute, a good diver, you can make a lot of money. So that's one effort we're focusing on. There's also on our public tidelands, we have problems, but the magnitude is not as great as what we see on private tidelands. And we're seeing having lots and lots of and increasing reports of poachers coming in on private tidelands at night and stealing the oysters and clams. And that was the case that you, one of the cases you read about, where that was a pretty large and organized crime ring that was doing that with a number of employees that were basically stealing shellfish off public tidelands and private tidelands, because the money's there and the demand is there. So we have a lot of enforcement effort, not enough enforcement effort, because they're pulled in so many directions, but it's a real challenge. And the more these products are worth on the black market, the greater the incentive is to poach.
Thank you. Is there any, there again, how are they marketed? Is there an avenue there where you could make certain where people are sourcing these products?
Yes, there's a variety of ways, and again, the chief would be better one to speak of this. We have a special investigative unit within the enforcement program that does a lot of work on this, looking at how some of this illegal product might be getting mixed in with aquaculture product or legal product, and it's done at the airports when it's going to, most of this goes to China. A lot of the commercial. So there's a lot of different avenues, and I think it's sort of like drugs, I guess you could say. If there's a demand for it, there's a way to get it into that market, and if there's money to be made, it's going to happen. And of course, the biggest threat, and this is a real threat to the aquaculture industry and the treaty commercial fishery, is that you get some really contaminated product coming from areas that are closed for pollution problems into the market, and someone getting really sick and having that hit the news, and that could really put a damper on the legal harvest of shellfish.
I see that I just was in the news the other day that Steve Seymour opened a restaurant, an oyster restaurant in Birch Bay,
yep,
selling Drayton Harvest. So another positive economic spin-off, tourism.
Yep.
And also a plug for Steve now, too. Former employee of Fish and Wildlife, retired. Any other comments? Thanks, Rich. You're making me hungry early.
Thank you.
No public input on this. Okay.